All right, thanks. You may have a seat. We're here this afternoon on East Cherry Creek Valley Water and Sanitation District versus the Greeley Irrigation Company and others. Could I have an entry of appearances, please?
Yes, Karen Martinez for East Cherry Creek Valley Water and Sanitation District.
And will you be presenting the arguments, Mr. Mazzarines?
I will, unless there's a question on the possibility for the board story, right? East Cherry Creek did not brief that issue. Question on that, and Ms. Waring, Sarah Waring.
Well, that's even a remote possibility, she should be sitting in council. And your name is Ms. Waring?
That's correct.
What's your first name?
Starr.
Okay, if you want to come around and sit in council. And who do we have for Greeley Irrigation? Council?
Your Honor, this is a...
Yes, that's you. Okay, so you all are confused. So if that comes up, that's you. Why don't you say your name again if you would, Mr. Waring?
Yes, Ms. Waring.
All right, very good.
Your Honor, this is Chad Wallace on behalf of the State Engineer, Division Engineer for the State of Colorado.
Okay.
We are cross-appellants in this matter. Also at the council table is Mr. John Buchanan on behalf of Centennial Irrigation.
Okay, and on your side of the courtroom, who's going to be doing the arguments?
Your Honor, I am presuming to do most of the arguments. Again, if an issue regarding Fossil Creek Reservoir happens to come up, Mr. Buchanan is available to address it.
Okay, thank you. Have a seat. So this is only an hour case. That means each side has half an hour. You may use your time any way you wish. If you do need to keep track of it and if you wish to reserve anything, you need to do so yourselves. So let's get started, please, Mr. Mazzarines.
May it please the court, this is an appeal on behalf of East Cherry Creek Valley and Water Sanitation District, who is the applicant to the water court below. I'll be referring to East Cherry Creek as ECCV for most of the arguments. In the case below, ECCV filed a change of water rights application seeking to change the use of 5.472 shares out of the 519.7 outstanding shares in the Greeley Irrigation Company, GIC, which I'll refer to as GIC throughout these oral arguments. GIC is a mutual ditch company, and ECCV sought to change the use of its shares from irrigation use to use as a source of substitute supply in a plan for augmentation. In their application to the water court and in engineering, they submitted as part of the case, circulated as part of the case. ECCV, the applicant, relied upon a ditch-wide quantification of GIC shares that had been previously quantified by the water court in case number 96 CW658. And that the decree in that case will be referred to as the Poudre Prairie decree and the Poudre Prairie case. In the matter that's before you, the ECCV filed at the water court level a Rule 56H motion with the water court, asserting that pursuant to this court's ruling in Midway Ranches, the Poudre Prairie decree was res judicata with respect to the quantification of the historical consumptive use for each Poudre Prairie ditch company share, unless there had been a change in circumstances subsequent to the entry of the Poudre Prairie decree. ECCB also argued that it was entitled to a rebuttable presumption that the historical consumptive use that was adjudicated by the Poudre Prairie decree for each GSC share was correct, and that the burden of proving change in circumstances since the Poudre Prairie decree was entered rested with the objectors. And I want to refer to our motion shorthand two issues: passage of time issue, which is the issue about whether we're, whether the Poudre Prairie decree and Midway Ranches projects forward and covers the time as far as res judicata from the time the decree was entered until the time the CCD's motion is filed, and then the presumption issue, the rebuttal presumption issue. Ruling for the State and Division Engineers, the Water Court ruled against DCCD, and that was a Poudre Prairie decree is not res judicata with respect to the historical consumptive use for each GIC share. And also ruled that the applicants bear the burden of proving a lack of change of circumstances since the Poudre Prairie decree was entered. So rather than a rebuttable presumption in favor of the applicants had to show that there had been a lack of change circumstances since the Poudre Prairie decree was entered. To understand this case, it's important to understand the Poudre Prairie decree in detail. The Poudre Prairie decree was entered on June 15, 1998. The state and division engineers were parties. The applicant in the Poudre Prairie decree, which is the Poudre Prairie Mutual Company, Mutual Reservoir Company, changed the use of 67.75 out of 519.7 GIC shares for use in the plan for augmentation. However, they quantified on a ditch-wide basis the historical consumptive use of all the shares, all 519.7 shares. And again, the PIC is a mutual ditch company. The applicants used a ditch-wide study period of 1950 through 1979. Paragraph 6.3.1 of the Poudre Prairie Decree states that this period encompassed wet, dry, and average years, and was representative of historic use. The Poudre Prairie Decree ditch-wide analysis determines the average annual diversions, irrigated acreage, and ditch loss throughout that period of historical use. And it expressly contemplates that GIC shares would be quantified and changed in future cases pursuant to its terms. It includes terms and conditions to prevent injury from such future changes. It limits the amount of land each GIC shareholder may irrigate in the future. It prohibits the GIC from issuing new shares in the future unless new water rights are acquired by the GIC. It identifies dried up acreage under the ditch that can be claimed in subsequent change cases. And it determines that the average historical consumptive use per share is 10.31 acre feet. Most importantly, Paragraph 20 of the Poudre Prairie Decree states, applicant or any other owner of shares in the GIC system may rely on the findings made herein regarding historic consumptive use, amount and location of use, and dried up historically irrigated acreage and related matters determined herein in any future applications for change in subject water rights reflected by GIC shares, which determinations shall be res judicata in the absence of a showing of subsequent events which were not addressed by the court herein and which are germane to the question of injury, and then it cites the Midway Ranches.
Well, would you agree that in any event there has to be some kind of a factual findings back in the trial court based on the Sedalia case? And doesn't that case speak almost exactly to what Judge Hartman arguably reserved, that is, the required showings that an applicant for a change must make, including showings that no injury is going to be caused. I assume you're going to take this water out of the ditch entirely and divert it somewhere else, right?
That's correct. We're going to use the water in a plan for augmentation, okay, already decreed plan for augmentation.
Okay, so I'm not sure where we are, I guess, and like I think the court would be interested in knowing why we need to do anything with this right now in light of the fact there has to be some kind of a showing, it would seem to be by the applicant, of what happened factually to these shares. Were they used, were they not used?
All right.
In the time period since the Poudre Prairie decree was entered, along with the second showing in the Santa Fe and
the first
Trails Ranchers, which is you got to show no injury to other water rights when you're, when you want to make a change.
Well, there are a lot of questions there, Justice Hobbs.
Of course.
I'll try and answer most of them.
Yeah.
But let me, I first want to point out that the paragraph I just cited is a finding by the court, by the water court, in a decree, a determination that future applicants were entitled to rely upon the quantification of historical consumptive use.
Well, sure, that might be.
And that's a distinction, pardon me.
That might be a starting point, but didn't we plainly say in Sedalia that implied into every water right decree is the condition of beneficial use? So certainly there has to be some showing, because they're not.
That's a distinction from Sedalia, because Sedalia is not a forward-looking decree. Sedalia was not a adjudication of a ditch-wide analysis of mutual ditch company water rights. And Sedalia did not contemplate that future applicants would change water rights that are adjudicated by that, by the decree that was the subject of that appeal in future change cases. So that's a material difference between this case and the Sedalia decision, the facts of Sedalia. And that's why the facts of the Poudre Prairie decree are important. And that's why that paragraph I just read you is important, because that paragraph contemplates that future, unlike Sedalia, future applicants will rely upon historical consumptive use, first share historical consumptive use that was determined by the prior adjudication.
Can you stay with that just a second? I still don't quite understand that. Maybe I'm not picking up on the distinction between shares and a ditch-wide situation, but it seems to me, or at least I asked the question, that may apply to the use per individual share and its proportion of the whole, but what is there that's different about this ditch-wide situation that would prevent you from having to reestablish the historic consumptive use ditch-wide since the last decree?
This court in Midway Ranches at page 526 stated that, I think the language is ordinarily or as a general matter, the quantification of historical consumptive use that was determined when there's a ditch-wide analysis of the water.
Actually, does it talk about yield per share in that passage that you're?
Well, it also talks about ditch-wide analysis. So you look at take a mutual ditch company, you look at all the water rights that are owned by it, you quantify the historical consumptive use that are attributable to those rights. Then, because it's a mutual ditch company, you take the number of outstanding shares, and under Jacobucci and all the case law of Midway Ranches, basically divide that yield according to the number of shares. And the policy that was articulated in Midway Ranches, and which was expressly adopted by the Poudre Prairie decree, and again, courts can make mistakes. So even if Poudre Prairie was wrong,
that's right. I don't think we're debating that.
We're thinking it's right, and it's right.
But with regard to Justice Hobbs' question about Sedalia, you're not challenging the finding.
Yes, yes.
Poudre, but going forward.
Sorry, pardon me.
Yeah, please.
So the quantification per share is allocated based on the ditch-wide analysis. The policy in articulated Midway Ranches is that there will be subsequent changes of those shares, and that as a matter, because the water that's allocated and appropriated by mutual ditch companies is such an important resource, predictability, reliability, stability for future changes, that quantification needs to be relatively established. Now, we're not arguing that it's established in perpetuity, unlike the applicants and the appellants in Sedalia. But we're arguing that there should be a presumption of correctness with regard to that quantification.
Even with regard to the historic use of the entire ditch, you think that's what Midway meant, rather than simply it's unlikely that the yield per share would change, and therefore we're not going to, in every case, look at the individual shares in some way, try to come up with some scheme to do that. But you're saying, unlike the situation that is not a whatever the term is, where we haven't broken up into shares. Unlike that situation, with this one, you don't even have to reestablish or establish that over a significant period, the consumptive use of the ditch is, has not changed.
Correct. It is the historical consumptive use of the ditch, and then that shares prorated allocation of that historical consumptive use. There's no burden.
Is there a rationale for why that would be? Maybe you could explain that.
The rationale would be Midway Ranches, where the court stated that it was, and let me go to the language of that. When historical consumptive use had been quantified for the ditch system by a previous court determination, the yield per share which can be removed for use in an augmentation plan is not expected to differ from augmentation to augmentation case to augmentation case, absent a showing of subsequent events which were not previously addressed by the water court but which are germane to the intervening inquiry in the case. So and the concept is that you have a mutual ditch company which has a finite number of shares. You have applicants who are acquiring those shares over time and transferring them over time. And rather than have to, once that initial ditch-wide analysis is done, it's expensive and it takes time and it's a major allocation of resources. Subsequent allocation, that subsequent applicants are entitled to rely upon those determinations to save for predictability, so they can know that the historical consumptive use that's attributable to that right for planning purposes and for purposes of determining how soon there are changes.
Could I just rephrase real quickly just to see if I'm, it sounds to me like what the argument you're making is if it's a mutual ditch company, then there is just the presumption that their historic consumptive use will not change.
A rebuttable presumption, that is our argument. But it's still subject to, as is articulated in Midway Ranches, articulated in the Coosa Prairie Decree, subject to the res judicata exception of changing circumstances. So we're not arguing that the waterway is...
Well, let me take up on Justice Kotler. We did reject the idea that on either side of this equation, and there's plenty of briefing on the issue that we decided in Sedalia, at least I think we're just looking forward to hearing what the council has to say on behalf of the clients. But we basically said, I believe, that that period of historical consumptive use is fixed and determined until such time as there is a changed circumstance. And that we don't go looking for a new representative historical period of time unless there's a significant period of prolonged, unjustified non-use, which would seem to say that an applicant going in with these ditch company shares that have been quantified before would have a starting point, whatever number of acre feet per share. But certainly to protect against injury, if you're going to move the point of diversion or some other kind of thing, you may have to dedicate part of that consumptive use to satisfying injury to other waterways. So you're certainly not arguing, I don't think, that you're absolutely entitled to X number of acre feet that you can then take into your municipal system if you have to use it to protect against injury. And number two, didn't we say that somehow there has to be, someone has to pick up this burden, and usually the applicant has the burden of showing what's been in play since the adjudication of the consumptive use. In other words, has the water right been utilized?
As
I understand what you opened with, is that immediately you waive the preferred decree and the other side then has some kind of burden to go forward. That's not my understanding of how it works. Now, why can't you just put on the evidence about how the water has been used in the ditch or from the ditch, and also these shares that they have actually been continued to be used in irrigation, whatever they've been used for, and then the burden might shift. But what? Your position, it seems to me, says that there's some kind of legal doctrine, which I don't know of, and I don't know how it could survive Sedalia, that is absolutely locked in perpetuity.
In Sedalia, this court rejected the notion that the passage of time constitutes change in circumstances as a matter of law. I mean, it's a clear holding in Sedalia. So if the passage of time does not constitute the change of circumstances as a matter of law, then it becomes a factual issue. So the water court effectively agreed with the state in its ruling and said passage of time constitutes a change of circumstances as a matter of law. Burden is on us to show that there hasn't been a change of circumstances. We don't think that can be reconciled with the determinations that this court issued in Midway Ranches or the findings by the water court earlier in the Poudre Prairie decree. If that historical consumptive use quantification was adjudicated in the Poudre Prairie decree has meaning going forward, the passage of time cannot automatically constitute a change in circumstances as a matter of law. So then it comes down to who bears the burden. Because, you know, there has to be that vacuum of time, because we're not arguing that water right is quantified in perpetuity. Who bears the burden?
Well, it looks to me, in all due respect, that you're asking us to make a trial court in limine decision here, because it seems to me there's a fair reading of Judge Hartman's order that he was basically saying it's up to the applicant to show what's happened in the meantime, and I need some evidence, and we certainly sent back Sedalia because there was a lack of evidence, and we were not real impressed about these polar opposite legal arguments in the absence of a factual record.
Well, our position is that in the absence of evidence, we're entitled to rely upon the historical consumptive use determination that was already reached by the court, as the water court had said in its own decision, and as the burden of showing that there has been a change in circumstances rests on objectors. For that proposition, we cited in our briefs, and I think it is analogous, is the Widener versus Allen case, which is a...
Here's the thing why I don't think that works, is because the ditch company is in control of the diversions into the system, and what is not being diverted in the system that's being counted against the water, right? I mean, why shouldn't the company establish some kind of prima facie showing that the water right has been in play the whole time since the adjudication of the Poudre Prairie decree? It seems to be that you would be able to make that showing. Now, if you can't make that showing when you're into this prolonged non-use, then there may be a duty on the water judge to look to see whether there's another representative historical period of time that ought to be used. So I
guess I disagree that's a simple showing. That requires a substantial expenditure of resources, and the argument starts to become, is it just that particular, those shares versus the shares of the entire company? And then, to the extent water was used by other shareholders, which other shareholders are entitled to do under a mutual ditch company, how did that use occur? The period of time since the Poudre Prairie decree was entered is 24 years.
Well, if you can't do it, how is an opposer going to do it? How is some other ditch company on the stream
going
to have to carry this burden when you're in control of it? Ditch.
Well, but the ditch company records are public records. In fact, the diversion records are kept by the state engineer. The irrigated acreage is available through satellite photos, and that's also publicly been available information under the SPDSS now. There's no unique information that a mutual ditch company has with regards to the use under its company other than ownership. But again, under the law and the premise of the case is that each applicant is entitled to a prorated portion of the water right that's owned by the ditch company. So that generally isn't an issue as well.
Counsel, but before you sit down, can I get you to address the 54B argument?
I'm glad to address the 54B argument. Although I am going to reserve some time in rebuttal since it's not my issue on appeal.
Yeah, I understand. I'm preemptively asking.
Sure. the first thing I want to point out is that the argument that's made by the state on 54B basically begs the issue that's up on appeal. The state never explains how we are correct, the DCCB is correct on the merits arguendo, its 54B motion should prevail. the state's 54B motion is premised upon its view of the law. So I think that's the first part. Secondly, I think Judge Hartman, when he certified our motion to certify as final judgment, hit the nail on the head. Our claim in this case was to quantify the historical consumptive use of these water rights based upon the Poudre Prairie Decree. That's what was noticed. That's what was pled to the court. And inextricably linked to that claim is our theory of changed circumstances, which is what we've been talking about for the last 23 minutes. If you look at the Nagarith case, the rationale that the judge relied upon by ruling against us on that claim, he essentially disposed of the heart of our motion. And if the remaining issues go to prevention of injury, not quantification of the historical consumption use, which is the purpose of the change case. So his point that he basically disposed of our case substantively is correct. The other thing I'm going to point out quickly is that it's really a form over substance argument. If you look at the Santa Fe Trail case, which is in the briefs, they dealt with the same issue. Basically, the issue there was a model expansion of use. The applicants filed a Rule 56H motion on that. They lost. They went to the court, to the water court, and basically said, please, given the court's ruling, we cannot meet our proofs at trial. Asked for dismissal. The court dismissed the case. They appealed the matter then to the Supreme Court. That's the same position we're in. So it's really a form of substance argument the state has raised. So I'd like to preserve the balance, if I may, yeah. Unless you have a follow-up. I'd be glad to answer a follow-up question.
No, I'm good.
All right. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. As I said earlier, my name is Chad Wallace. I'm here to represent the city engineer and division engineer in this appeal as the cross appellants. I'd like to start off by saying I'm going to address two main issues in this argument. First is the engineer's cross appeal. The trial court certification of a partial final judgment under Rule 54B was an error because the entirety of applicants' water right change case remains before the trial court for full determination. Second, the engineers are contesting that the applicants in this case are incorrect in their assertion that there is a presumption as a matter of law to the application of claim preclusion in water rights cases. The applicant went over some of the procedural posture of this case. It's not the clearest one be presented before this court, so I'll take a few moments to go over that once again. The applicants own shares in Great Irrigation Company, or GIC, filed an application to change that water right for use in an augmentation plan. As part of that change application to advance their trial strategy, applicants filed a Rule 56H motion for determination questions of law that they were entitled to the presumption of claim preclusion rely on this Poudre Prairie Decree, which is a prior change case that used a ditch-wide analysis of some of the water rights involved. If some of the water rights were being changed, the ditch-wide, of course, looked at the entirety of the ditch operations. That case was entered in 1998 as a final decree. So we've got 17 years, approximately, since that decree was entered. The trial court denied that Rule 56H motion on a number of grounds that are in the record. Applicants then sought certification that the denial of that legal motion constituted a partial final judgment so that they could bring this appeal. That brings me to the engineer's first point, which is there is no partial final judgment here. And this case should be dismissed by this court and sent back to the trial court below for a trial on the merits of this case.
Now, you're not arguing that every year of zero use is a non-use year. You got past that based on Sedalia? I mean, what is your position on that?
All right, to skip ahead, what do we do with what you caught?
I think it has to do with what Judge Hartman really said. He needed facts on it.
Yeah, we agree with, we are not contesting that opinion. Our position is that Res judicata is applied up to 1998. That is the date that the Coup de Prairie decree was entered. Then I think, Justice Hobbs, your question is, what do we do afterwards? We simply can't tell you what we do afterwards because we don't have any facts for the past 17 years of use. It is not our contention here today that we have to enter zeros for every year of non-use. But we don't know what we need to do. We don't know what was done with this water line. We don't know whether, how it was used. We don't know basically the two big factors in the Sedalia case that this court published a few weeks ago, which is what is the amount of water available for the change? And what terms and conditions are necessary to prevent injury to other water rights pursuant to that change? The trial court has not ruled on either of those two factors. And we're not here to give an opinion on those because we don't have the facts. So this is why we filed the cross appeal. We don't have the facts necessary to have an informed opinion from this court of what to do going forward. We're still in the middle of that process to develop that.
Well, so, could I get you to go back to the 54B then and just kind of close the circle? So I guess your position on 54B is that all the trial court or water court said in this case was you cannot entirely rely on this prior decree. That doesn't end the inquiry. You have to go forward and make a showing, and there's been no showing, therefore no final judgment. I mean, is that your position?
Yes. The trial court did not quantify the rights or limit the use of any of the rights or determine what the study period ought to be in this case. It simply determined the applicants were not entitled as a matter of law without presenting facts to force everyone to use those quantifications and those factors to include very quickly. So in order to get a partial final judgment here, it would be an appeal for us to know what we need to issue a ruling on. The applicant has the burden to show three different factors, which are that there was a ruling on the entire claim for relief, that there was a final or ultimate disposition on that claim, and that there's no just reason for delay. Now, in the 54B certification, the trial court found there was no just reason for delay. And the case law fairly well shows the trial court was owed deference on that final, the third element. But the other two elements are reviewed by this court de novo. So there is no deference owed to the trial court on any findings in that regard. In here, we essentially have everything left for the trial court to determine. There is no final disposition of anything. Under Rule 54B, you can have a partial final judgment, of course, if you've got multiple claims from multiple parties. And you have a ruling on less than all of those claims, or against fewer than all of those parties. We don't have either of those. We've got all of the opposers that are still in the case that have not had their rights determined. So this is easily distinguished from the U.S. v. Bell case, in which senior water rights were no longer at risk because the antedation to the United States Reserve Right application is denied. That's not the issue here. We also have the one and only claim by applicants to change their GIC shares, still fully at issue. That has not been resolved in any respect. The priority date has not been resolved. The quantification per share has not been resolved. The representative study period has not been resolved.
Could I interrupt you there? Would any of those things in a change of water right application constitute a partial judgment? Or, and I'm asking for your argument. You raised those as those things haven't happened, but you seem to be saying in this context, in a change of water right application, it's either granted or it's denied, and there ain't anything in between.
Well, if you look at some of the cases in the briefs, there's an argument to be made that in the U.S. v. Bell case, when the court denied antedation of a reserved water right, that an amendment made by the United States could not relate back to the original reserve right claim, that did dispose of, as to that amendment, the priority date for that right, and the case, that aspect was ripe for appeal. That is the law there. In this case, of course, we don't have those facts yet. The court has not ruled dispositively on any of those issues. And even if we were to accept the applicant's argument about the rebuttable presumption as to what it's entitled to rely on in the Coup de Prairie case, we're not there yet. We're still in the middle of that process. So even if you were to accept the argument of the rebuttable presumption, you need to have that presumption, an opportunity for the other parties in that case to rebut, the court then to rule on the outcome of that situation, and then to appeal and say, now we have a ruling on priority and some quantification on study period. But we're still in the middle of that. We have no facts presented by applicants and no rebuttal presented by the rest of the opposing. We're simply too early into that case.
So why can't we keep this case and decide whether or not there's a presumption or not? Of course, the presumption has never been mentioned in Midway or any other case. We would be making some law, wouldn't we?
That would presume there is a presumption somewhere in the case law, in which I would argue that there is not. Midway Ranches did not establish any different standard of law for claim preclusion. In fact, Midway Ranches, as well as Farmers Highline Canal and the recent Sedalia opinion, all confirm that claim preclusion and issue preclusion apply to water cases just as they do to other forms of litigation. So in that case, we need to finish that process for the court to actually determine what has been applied. And right here, the court hasn't gotten that far yet. Simply said, applicants need to actually present their evidence to meet the factors of preclusion, which it is not. In their 56H motion, applicants came forward with a legal theory that they are entitled as a matter of law to claim preclusion, when in fact, there is no presumption to claim preclusion, as they've argued in Midway Ranches. And Midway Ranches does have the language about an expectation that the quantification per share is not expected to differ. However, the resolution of what these future change cases would be was not necessarily to resolve the Midway case. And in fact, the expectation is based on the fact that it would not be changes since then. But it did not create a presumption of applying claim preclusion and changing the law. In fact, this court issued in its Farmers Highline Canal case an opinion that applied claim preclusion to a water case. And in that case, the plaintiffs were using a declaratory judgment action to try and crack open an existing water rights decree. So it was not a change of use case. They were trying to go to an existing decree in which the water users were using water according to that decree and add additional conditions on the use of that water right. And this court analyzed the ability to do that under claim preclusion. And in this case, it was after Midway Ranches and reiterated the four elements needed by the party asserting claim preclusion. This identity of the cause of action, identity of subject matter, identity of parties, and that the parties were in the same position that they had been in the prior case. This court reiterated slightly different four elements necessary for claim preclusion, but nonetheless, it reiterated that the party asserting claim preclusion has the burden to establish those factors. And that simply hasn't been done at this point.
Counsel, can I get you to, before you move on, respond to opposing counsel's argument? I guess that this case differs in a couple of ways. One, we have a decree that seems to suggest that this is a forward-looking determination. And also, I guess this is a mutual ditch case, which is different from Sedalia. I'm wondering if you could focus in on those two arguments.
Right. If this court gets that far, I don't think it's necessary to read the Poudre Prairie Decree that way. That is, that it is prospectively limiting what trial courts in the future can and cannot take a look at, depending on what the facts are. One, I am not aware of any law that treats mutual ditch companies different than other entities with regard to the application of claim preclusion. It's simply not there. The party asserting claim preclusion has to prove those four elements. Now, with regard to them being different, I just don't see that that's there. The Sedalia court in that opinion, I think addresses that same question. The argument being a mutual ditch company has a number of shares that can be transferred within the mutual ditch company so that water can be used more efficiently. An applicant's argument would be, well, everyone within the mutual ditch company is using some of this water. Therefore, finding a ditch-wide quantity per share would apply to the entire company. Whereas in the Sedalia case, this court wasn't just looking at a mutual ditch company. This court was looking at the actual same water rights from a prior quantification and then a more recent change application. You can't get any more same water than that. And in that case, the court said, even though it's the exact same water, not even looking at how the mutual ditch company might move water around within the system, using the exact same water, there is still no hard and fast preclusion that prior quantification has to, as a matter of law, apply in a future case. So the court is still going to take that case and look at the circumstances at the time the application is made. That's the Midway Ranches. And it would rest on all the facts and showings by the applicant, because the applicant has the burden to show the amount of water available for change and the terms and conditions necessary to prevent injury.
So, I mean, sure, what got our attention in Midway Ranches was the possible multiplication of shares, which might have enlarged to the injury of other water users. And so that was the context of our expectation language, that as an applicant, you go forward with the expectation that it's going to be the same. You know, if you're showing you're using, you know, Colorado water is based on actual beneficial use, but uses vary. Water can be put to firm up a municipal water supply. It can be used for augmentation. Certainly, we flagged in Sedalia that you don't have to use augmentation water every year, right? It's a periodic use. So at play is the issue of whether that is even truly non-use. Isn't that issue open because of our Sedalia opinion?
It certainly will be once we get to the trial phase. What makes it difficult here is we don't have anything in the record even to build upon the Sedalia opinion of what was excused non-use. We have a number of statutory exceptions to non-use that don't diminish the value of that water right. We don't know what was used in the intervening 17 years in this circumstance. Now, if you look at the Midway Ranches, the expectation of water was not affected in the quantity per share. And even in that opinion, the applicants made a demonstration that they were entitled to use that past quantification in their case. The amount of shares that had remained the same, the type of use had remained the same. So in that circumstance—
Right, they'd be continued to be used for agriculture within that ditch.
Yes.
Except it's taken out for, you know, dropped in for augmentation.
And in that case, in Midway Ranch's case, that court made factual findings that the applicant was entitled to continue using that prior quantification in future cases. And it's the state's contention that we're not even close to that period yet. We're, as I said before, we're in the middle of the process. We don't know yet what the use in these intervening 17 years has been. And Justice Hobbs, you asked earlier, are we arguing that we have to re-quantify this water right because of the type of use and the amount of use that's happened in the past 17 years? That is not our position here today. Our position is that applicants are required to make a showing of what that was, and to make an argument about what the representative period ought to be. It may very well be exactly the same period as used in the Poudre Prairie case. They could have the same quantity per share as in the Poudre Prairie case, along with all the same terms and conditions to prevent injury. But at this point, we simply don't know if that's adequate, because applicant has made no showing of any of the use in the intervening 17 years.
Counsel, if I could interrupt you just a moment there. I'm trying to see if I understand your position with respect to the trial court order's determination with respect to burden. Who bears the burden of showing the absence of changed circumstances in terms of how that ties into the preclusive effect of the 1998 Poudre Decree? And my understanding of your argument to be that burden is wholly consistent with and sort of part and parcel of the affirmative showing that the changed applicant will have to make anyway about the availability of water and how the water has been used over the last 17 years, or is that something different?
I think it is really part and parcel of the same thing.
Okay.
I think when you're
when you look at the opinions, you've got these clear four factors for claim preclusion. Identity of subject matter, cause of action, parties, position of the parties. And that, I think, is analogous to really saying there's nothing changed. We have no changed circumstances. And admittedly, in Midway Ranch's case, that opinion is using a changed circumstances language, whereas in many other opinions regarding claim preclusion, it's setting forth these different elements. In the Staley case, the opinion has both. The opinion both mentions changed circumstances and elements of claim preclusion. I think it's consistent to read those as part of the same thing. That is, if there are no changed circumstances, when an applicant comes in to change their water right, they are going to have identity of subject matter of claims of parties. Now, as a practical matter, I think it may be difficult to demonstrate all of those. This court has said in the Ready Mix case that a change in water right application opens the door to requalification. We're not arguing it mandates, but it at least opens the door to reevaluation of the circumstances at the time of that application. In this case, we have different individual shares that are being changed for a different use to augment different structures by a different applicant. Likewise, we've got a different potential period of representative use. We've got 17 years since this water right has last been examined, so we don't know whether that past examination remains valid. We also have a number of new water rights that have come on the system since 1998. Those parties were not in a position to argue injury to their water rights because they did not have them, but they are there today, and they are entitled as junior water right owners to maintenance the conditions of the stream at the time they come on the system. So those are circumstances that could...
Are arguably subject to the consumptive use draw that belongs to the water right, correct?
Yes.
Now, we're not slipping back into that argument we heard last time, right?
I'm simply pointing out that we have factors that the trial court needs yet to analyze, and those issues have not been brought up. I cannot sit here today and say there are juniors who will for sure be injured because of some prolonged period of non-use, because I can't point anywhere in the record where that would be demonstrated. The point I'm making is that, one, we have no final judgment here. And two, even if we had a final judgment that would allow jurisdiction for an appeal from this court, that the trial court's ruling on the 56H motion was correct, that the applicant has the burden because the applicant's trying to show claim preclusion, to demonstrate all those factors of claim preclusion.
What's your position on the reopening of the decree to add monthly consumptive use figures on the Fossil Creek water?
Our position on that, without getting into specifics, is that I think it's the applicant's initial burden to demonstrate what is in fact available to them to change and what's necessary to prevent injury. And they may very well come forward and say, what we already got from a prior case works in this change application. And that would be then going forward with their initial burden. An opposer is then certainly welcome to say, well, this doesn't work for the following reasons. And if we've got, we're not looking at requalifying as a mandate, but simply requiring the applicant to go forward and establish what it's got available to change. And so that's similar to the applicants are arguing that the mere passage of time creates a mandate to requalify the water right. That's not necessarily so. If in fact there are going to change circumstances and they have that same amount of water available to them, that's through a representative study period, and it's not causing injury, that water may still be available fully for them to change. This is simply another reason why we don't even have a partial final judgment here. Applicants could end up, even if they had a rebuttable presumption,
they could still end up with the very same amount of water that they originally applied to change. Or we could have yet facts introduced to the trial court that even if they have a rebuttable presumption, might end up with some different number. And at this point, we just don't know. Well, I'd like to just address a couple more topics that the trial court below denied the 56H motion, that there is no presumption as a matter of law. And one of the many reasons why that was correct is that the applicants failed to meet their burden to show that there are no disputed issues of material fact. Part of that is because applicant's strategy was to rely on a legal presumption claim preclusion rather than showing that it actually applied. We simply don't have the facts that are undisputed to support what we're finding in that regard. Advocates have pointed out that agree with a number of subsequent cases that used the Hooter Prairie quantifications. Now, these are cases since 1998 before today. And those cases did use the Hooter Prairie for quantifications. However, the trial court correctly found that that was so because the applicants in those cases successfully demonstrated that was the amount of water that they had entitled to change, and they could use the terms and conditions in that decree without causing injury to other water rights. In other words, there was an analysis made by the trial court to apply those factors. Because a factual analysis was made, there was no claim preclusion. It's simply the trial court engaged in the fact-finding process and ended up at the same place as a Hooter Prairie decree. That could happen in this case. We just don't know yet. So again, I'd just like to reiterate the engineer's position that this case is actually not correctly postured for appeal because we don't have the final judgments. Everything is awaiting trial at the water court below. If this court were to advance in a rule on the issues regarding claim preclusion, there's no reason to end up any differently than it did in the Sedalia case, which is that there is no prescription that a past quantification must apply to future cases. Instead, the applicant takes those issues to trial to demonstrate the amount of water as available for the change and the terms and conditions necessary to prevent injury. So in the first instance, the court doesn't dismiss this appeal outright. I would urge it to uphold the water court's ruling that the applicants are not entitled as a matter of law to a presumption of claim preclusion. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time to address my issues on the cross appeal. Thank you.
I'd like to first address the party issue that Mr. Walls raised and then go back to this change in circumstances presumption issue. The junior appropriators issue is really a red herring. The state is a party to the Hooter Prairie decree. We gave notice that we were going to rely upon the Hooter Prairie historical consumptive use adjudication as part of this proceeding, so any appropriate out there had notice of that. Hooter Prairie decree was noticed that it would be a ditch-wide quantification. And then as far as the parties of the proceeding, in this proceeding, there's no party that joined the state on their side as far as the briefing. So this is a fictitious junior appropriator that's out there. And as far as the parties that are before us, there's no such thing. Moving back to the presumption issue, the Hooter Prairie study created in 1979, which is 24 years ago. So if that quantification of historical consumption use is the dinner in that state entitled to some degree of deference, the issue becomes who bears the burden of proving the
Well, I would want to just put a footnote on that and say that it would be 1998.
Okay, I understand.
Right? The answer to the decree, isn't that what we said in Sedalia?
And that was ambiguous in the state's brief.
When it was issued, that decree was issued, the quantification period was set. Right?
I'll concede 1998, that's great. So we'll go, so 17 years. 17 years right. Of since that decree was entered.
And this, the issue is the same. Who bears the burden of proving that there's been a change in circumstances? It's not a hypothetical issue, as Mr. Wallace contended. It's not, you know, if you're in a court, and Judge Hartman case, this is why he granted our motion for final certification. We have to, it goes to trial preparation, it goes to trial to witness preparation, it goes to cost, it goes to litigation, it goes to expense, it goes to strategy, all those things. Who bears that proof? Paragraph 20 of the Poudre Prairie Decree says that in the absence of a showing of subsequent events which were not addressed by the court and which are germane to the question of injury, any owner of GIC shares may rely upon those historical quantifications in the future. That language directly tracks the Prairie Ranches. In the absence of a showing of subsequent events. Judge Hartman and the state turn that language on its head and are basically ruling that if there's past that there's a presumption that a change in circumstances occurred due to the passage of time, and the burden is on us to show that wasn't the change in circumstances. Which the express language is in the absence of a showing of subsequent events. We have to do nothing. We're relying on the language. We have no proof that we need to rely on. So that's the whole premise of the rebuttable presumption. If you go to Wagner versus Allen, this court established precedent for creation of rebuttable presumption in a water court proceeding. In that matter, the court found that applicants changing the use of mutual ditch company shares are entitled to a rebuttable presumption if the historical diversions under their share were the probate amount of diversions under the subject water right.
Okay, here's the problem, I think, you know, your time's getting short.
Yes, it is.
In the exempt well situation, there is a presumption of non-injury that is rebutted. The statute is, right?
Yes.
Okay. The normal law that we're all used to as water lawyers in these cases is that the applicant has the burden of the prima facie showing, and then the burden going forward shifts to the opposers, and then the ultimate burden is upon the applicant. You would agree that's standard stuff of the water
case. That's right? Standard, and that's why I'm pointing
to
the law.
So what statutory language or court language are you relying on for this assertion of a presumption?
Well, again, the language in Midway Ranches, page 25.
There's not a mention of the word presumption.
Well, the statement of expectation, and when you go from case to case, you repeat, there's an expectation, you can obtain that historical consumption use quantification. As close to a type of presumption, and as we cite in our briefs, the expectation is synonymous with a presumption under the standard English language. But that's why I'm pointing to Wagner versus Allen. There, the court did establish a presumption as a matter of common law, which is the bedrock of water law, I would argue, the common law. And there were allegations of injury in that context, but the court said. Characterized those as potential injury and said in the absence of demonstrable injury, you're entitled to this presumption. And so it did allow the applicants to have that presumption in their favor, and the objectors, in the absence of demonstrable injury, had the burden of showing, of proving the otherwise, approving that the diversions that were claimed by the applicant under the presumption didn't really occur. And that's what we're arguing here. We're not saying we're entitled to the quantification of this historical consumption use in perpetuity. We're saying that we're entitled to the presumption that's valid, and that the burden of showing that it's invalid, that there has been a change in circumstances in the last 24, 17, whatever number of years, is upon the state. It's not a hypothetical issue. It's expensive for allocation trial strategy. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Your Honors, I've just got a few moments, and I want to just reiterate some of our positions on our cross-appeal regarding the 54B final judgment certification. We are not necessarily assuming the mere passage of time has so changed these circumstances that a change is going to happen. But what we have here is, as Justice Hobbs has pointed out, a water case in which it is normal for an applicant, it's the initial burden, to allow any opposers in that case to present their own evidence to rebut that initial burden, and then to have the applicants carry that final burden, the ultimate burden of proof for the change of water right. We haven't even started these steps. Applicant hasn't presented any evidence as to the use of its water right, whether there are changed circumstances, what is the appropriate representative study period, or the amount of water per share, or terms and conditions for prevent injury. We're simply proceeding on this presumption of this new legal presumption.
Can I interrupt and ask you a question? I don't mean really be throwing you a ringer here, but it does seem to me you're asking us to dismiss on the grounds that this is not an appealable judgment. And we've had a great deal of activity now and delay and briefing. In the criminal context, we have before found that the case before us was not an appealable judgment, and yet we've gone on and decided to invoke our original jurisdiction to resolve a question. Would that be appropriate here?
That's a good question, and I have read the statutes actually preparing the briefs, but I cannot remember the citations, so you have to forgive me. We do have rules that allow interlocutory appeals, specifically from criminal cases. We do not have them for water cases. And it's within the court's discretion to create its own rules on accepting appeals. What we do have is a statute that does allow a direct appeal of water cases to this court. So we don't have an intermediate appellate court. I would caution that accepting interlocutory appeals of water matters in order to streamline the trial process would invite any number of appeals on various legal and procedural motions to this court.
And let me just clarify this a little, and I realize this is not the area maybe where you practice all the time, but I wasn't suggesting an interlocutory appeal. Quite the contrary, we have in the past held that an interlocutory appeal or an appeal of that was brought to us on the grounds that it was final because it was a collateral order were not that, and therefore they were not appealable, and therefore there was no right. But we could exercise our discretion in any individual case without giving appellants in future cases a right to appeal to us to go ahead and resolve the question because of the posture in which the case finds itself before us. And I guess I was kind of looking for a policy reason or a reason why we shouldn't do that, even if we were to agree with you.
I'm actually a bit hesitant on trying to instruct the court on policy issues. Though I think it is an important question, and I think there probably is also a reason why water cases are allowed to direct appeal to this court, because the people of the state found them to be significantly weighty matters and wanted resolutions, perhaps very similar to criminal issues in which a person's liberty is at stake. But even if a question were to be, say, certified to this court, under original or otherwise, I would suggest that it would be best to accept those questions when this court has enough facts to issue a well-reasoned opinion. That we have an offer proof by the applicants, we have potential opposing facts by the other opposers, so that this court would know how those facts actually played out, rather than presenting an abstract legal theory without underlying support. In essence, asking this court to create new law through a policy directive.
But why do we need more facts to resolve the burden shifting issue? Why isn't it, just to speak back to what Justice Hobbs was pointing out earlier, why shouldn't we at least try to accomplish that much here if one assumes that there's enough ambiguity under 54B to allow us to get there, or through original jurisdiction under 21.
Or even with Judge Hartman for further arguments based on Sedalia, et cetera.
Well, that's his question.
Just
please answer them all in 5 seconds.
In the 2 seconds I have, I would suggest that the burden shifting question has not actually disposed of anybody's rights or any claims at this point. And really what we're talking about is an economy of trial proceedings. And even under the law,
the person trying to establish their case is going to have the initial burden, not the other way around. So I would suggest that the burden shifting issue, where the burden lies, is currently defined by the law. And that nobody's rights have been finally disposed of at this point. It's really an issue of the trial court simply instructing one of the parties to present evidence in order to ultimately get to it. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Right, thanks very much. We do appreciate the argument of both counsel, and the report will be in recess until tomorrow at 9:00.